Welcome to Online Gods, a podcast about digital cultures in India and beyond. This month, we're talking about digital news images with Zainab Gursel and online surveillance with Nayantara Ranganathan. I'm your host, Ian Cook. What is it that allows certain things to circulate through digital networks and others not? What sort of labour goes into moving certain things along and holding certain things up? How aware are we of the digital architectures through which data, often our data, flows? In this episode of Online Gods, we're going to be exploring these questions and related questions across two different topics: news images and online surveillance. As always, first we speak to a scholar about a concept or theory or some research, and then to an online god, someone who is doing something interesting or influential in the digital sphere in India. In the first half of the podcast, me and my co-host and boss, Sahan Urupa, are going to discuss digital news images with anthropologist Zainab Gursel, who has undertaken ethnography with those she calls image brokers, the individuals who help turn photographs and other images into news by selecting and circulating them. And then in the second half of the podcast, we'll be speaking with Nayantara Ranganathan, a program manager at the Internet Democracy Project, about their organization's work, specifically in regards to research and workshops relating to online surveillance. I hope you enjoy the podcast. What makes a photo news? Or maybe who makes a photograph a news image might be a better question. And a good person to answer that question is Zainab Gursel, professor at Rutgers University. And luckily, she spoke with me and Sahana a few weeks back to discuss just this. We talk quite a bit about her book, Image Brokers, Visualizing World News in the Age of Digital Circulation, which came out in 2016, and to which I'll put a link to on the site. And apart from this and articles relating to this, and among many other things, she has a real brilliant ethnographic film about Turkish politics called Coffee Futures, and is now working on a new project about the role of photography in the history of Armenian emigration to the United States called Portraits of Unbelonging. Let's listen to the interview. And it gives us great pleasure to welcome Zainab to Online Gods. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Hello, Zainab. Welcome to the podcast.
Pleasure to be with you today.
Wonderful. So today we're going to talk about visual images, digital visual images, and the people who broker them. And you conducted field work on this topic between 2003, 2005 in newsrooms and magazines and at photography events and workshops and so on. And I think it's really interesting because it was a time of digitalization. I guess that made it a really wonderful time to study because of the tensions that it threw up, not least in terms of what this process of digitalization did to the image and those who brokered them. So apologies for a rather abstract question to start, but I was wondering, can you begin by talking us through what sort of material thing is a digital image as opposed to an analog one, and why does it matter?
So let me start by just saying I'm interested in news images. So I'm going to focus on digital news images, okay? So I think news images are really fascinating objects. If I didn't, I wouldn't have spent nearly a decade of my life studying them, I suppose. But why are they fascinating objects? Because not all photographs are news images. A photograph becomes a news image by circulating in a journalistic publication, right? That's when we call a photograph a news image. It gets vetted, it gets confirmed to be a journalistic image. And so on the one hand, they are images like other images, and therefore they're aesthetic objects. We can talk about them as having, artistic nuances, or we can talk about their formatting and their framing, but they are also pieces of visual knowledge about the world that we live in. And at the same time, I'm very interested in the ways in which they don't just tell us about the world that we live in, they also sort of form what we expect of the world when we look into it, which is why I think of images, news images, as formative fictions, meaning that, yes, they represent the world as it is, but they also shape what we imagine is possible in the world as we know it.
That's really interesting. I mean, and I suppose bringing on from drawing on this, maybe a long time ago, or maybe still exists in some people's mind, there was the idea that the photograph was somehow a true representation of reality. But you're calling them here formative fictions. And so I was just wondering, like, how then do some images get to have more truth value ascribed to them as opposed to others? What's the process, how this takes place?
Right. So it's about how they circulate. So this is the part where I say certain news images accrue value by actually circulating in journalistic spaces, right? Maybe it would help if I give an example. This whole project started actually shortly before 9/11. And the first part of the project really was when 9/11 happened, I did interviews with people who, for various reasons, were keeping visual memorabilia of the event, either images that were on the front pages of newspapers, or they were keeping, you know, downloaded video from the events, which, you know, I spoke to one man who it took 45 minutes to download like a 3-minute video just to sort of recall that things were not as quick as they are today in the digital world. In any case, when I was doing these interviews, there was a lot of surprise amongst the people I was interviewing who were Americans in both California and New York. And when I asked about the images, they would say things like, it doesn't look like New York, referring to Ground Zero. And when I asked what it looked like, they would say, it looks like Lebanon, or it looks like Bosnia, or it looks like Iraq. That was actually an answer that I got several times. Now, remember, this was in 2001. So one of the things I started thinking about is how places are visualized impact how places are imaginable, or what kinds of political possibilities we imagine in various places. So certain places get imagined as dangerous or hostile. Other places get imagined as a country's heartland or peaceful or desirable. Does that make sense? Or prosperous?
Yeah. And just exactly on this then. So so you looked a lot at what you call, who you call brokers. So people who are really centrally involved in the moving around and the selection of these images. So could you talk us through maybe an example of what a broker might do to turn one of those images, you know, into something that is able to circulate and is able to get some sort of purchase in people's imagination?
Sure. So I would say, in fact, the most interesting thing that I got to do was make visible the labor of image brokers. Because image brokers is a term that I had to come up with in order to describe this function that is actually behind every news image, but really is typically invisible. An image broker is somebody who makes the image available to the public in one way or another, but there can be many steps in this. So it can be the person who commissions a photographer to go someplace in the first place or to take a certain photograph. It can be the agent who sells that photographer's work to a news publication. It can be the photo editor at the news publication who decides between many different options which particular image is going to visualize a certain news story. So image brokers are all of the people who in one way or another either contribute to the circulation of an image or prevent their circulation by keeping them out of networks in news production by editing them out. So let me give you, you asked for a particular example. I got to start my field work in the weeks, really the 3 weeks in the lead up to the American war in Iraq. And it was a very exciting time to be in a newsroom because everybody had sort of already decided that this was going to be a short-lived war, which proved not to be the case, and wanted to get sort of the iconic images of this war. And image brokers, at the time I was in a visual content provider's newsroom, and an image broker, one who I followed was Ed. So what would Ed do? Ed would make an arrangement with a particular news publication and say, hey, how about if we sell your photographer's production after the newspaper has run it, and we offer it to news magazines all around the world. So the newspaper is happy because this is extra revenue for them, and the visual content provider is happy because they are now selling the image elsewhere. Ed might also talk to a freelance photographer in Kuwait, waiting to go into Iraq and find out what the troops are doing that day, what types of photographs he's taking, and then turn around to various news publications and try to pitch that story. Oh, how about soldiers writing letters home to loved ones? Might that fit with whatever your editorial line is for the day? During that phone conversation, Ed might get some information from the editor at, let's say, a magazine saying, oh, actually, no, they're not interested in that, but they're really interested in, let's say, a war-weary soldier. We need a weary-looking soldier. And so then he might communicate that back to the photographer. Or, for example, he might say, actually, they're really interested in religion in the troops. So see if you can find any soldiers who are praying or any soldiers who have visible religious identifying marks. And then that might determine how the photographer shoots that day.
Absolutely. And this reminds me of the classic study on gatekeepers, right? News gatekeepers and newsroom ethnographies, talking about different processes involved in selection of news and images. So that's really fascinating work, Zainab. So let me jump in and take this discussion in a different direction. There are arguments that in the digital age, visualities have moved from a politics of representation to a politics of circulation. The so-called amateur, unofficial uploads have changed what it means to witness and feel in the image world, right? So multiple visual traces have brought tremendous uncertainty about events and claims. In fact, sometimes this has come in the way of any meaningful political action because one is not sure what is happening. But amateur uploads have also seeded skepticism that can in fact challenge official narratives. And you mentioned in your study that professional image brokers were already feeling the threat. So two questions then come up. One, politics of circulation. How do you see it unfolding? And second, the idea of brokerage. Is there a different sort of brokerage altogether with greater digitalization? And how are these developments affecting political debates and participation?
Great questions. So let me start with circulation and let me talk about why it was the turn to digitalization that made this such an interesting space for me to study as an ethnographer. It's not that digital images, even digital news images, didn't exist before 2003. They did. In fact, the AP shot the entire 1996 Super Bowl on digitally to prove that you could accomplish everything in digital just as you could in analog. However, what really changed was the way, the pace and scale at which images could circulate. And of course, this meant that you didn't need to be going through official channels such as wire services in order to circulate images. Okay, so I remember very clearly the first day I went to the editorial offices of a very prominent American news weekly I saw a chute at the end of the hallway, and it was the chute during which for decades you would have put the physical rolls of film, and they would have gone directly down to the lab to be developed as quickly as possible. On the chute, there was a big sign that read RIP, okay, rest in peace, and that was the end of the analog era. But in fact, a little-known story is that 9/11 was a very important moment for digital photojournalism, but not for the reasons that everybody assumes is the case. In other words, it wasn't because of something within the news story itself. It was because of the change in circulation. So the story that I want to tell is that the Federal Aviation Agency, as many of you may remember, actually grounded all flights for 3 days. And because flights could not take off for 3 days, the up to then very typical process of sending completed rolls to be developed via airline was not possible. So at that particular moment, it didn't matter if an image had been produced via analog technologies or digitally, it needed to circulate digitally. And that changed everything. So by the time the American war in Iraq began in 2003, you simply could not get an assignment in Iraq if you didn't have some way of circulating your images digitally. In fact, there were two very senior war correspondents who took along young technical assistants to help them with the transmission of their images. So let's fast forward to today. Today, I think we have a situation where circulation itself is sometimes news, which is to say that there can be times when that an image is circulating in a viral manner is itself a news story, regardless of the content or irrespective of the content of the actual image that is circulating. What has happened in the ensuing sort of 15 years since I did this research is one could say everybody's an image broker, or there are all kinds of image brokers today, which is true, right? There's constantly, we upload things to YouTube, people post things on Twitter. All of this these are examples of image brokering. So in some sense, and we were seeing this already during the time period that I was studying the photojournalism industry, the most talked about images were not professional photographs, but were, for example, the Abu Ghraib abuse photographs or the 2005 London bombing photographs taken by an amateur photographer on a cell phone. This meant that, yes, there was tremendous anxiety amongst professional image brokers and photographers about what was happening to this craft. And to a certain extent, they were absolutely right to be anxious because on the one hand, through the rise of things like social media, everybody's an image broker, right? My students broker images all the time, often without, you know, thinking too much about the political implications of brokering this image versus that one. Conversely, professional image brokers have almost all lost their jobs. And professional image brokering, so the attaching of an image to a news story, has increasingly become automated or become something that people have to do at such a rapid rate that there simply isn't the time for the kind of really deep, researched image brokering that I witnessed.
Right. And perhaps not just people, also algorithms and non-human actors are also brokering now.
Absolutely.
Anyway, my other question, when we had this discussion around digital media, We in fact called it the digital turn in media anthropology, and this was at the European Association for Social Anthropologists biennial conference when we had the Media Anthropology Network meeting. And there was a very interesting discussion on the power of images in the digital age. And one question that came up was, is visual the language of the digital? So do you believe that the visual has really become the most important kind of expression of the digital?
Well, I mean, what I would say is I don't lump all visuals together. And I think it's important to think, I guess I think a lot about labor behind news production. And so the reason I don't lump all visuals together is because oftentimes we're talking about different kinds of work behind different visual production. I do think there's no question that the future of news is visual. In terms of is the digital visual? I think for me, it's important to not think of a monolithic thing that is the digital, right? In my book, Image Brokers, I differentiate between digitization and digitalization. And I'm not trying to mince words here, but basically the difference comes down to digitization is turning something into digital bytes, right? But digitalization is all of the cultural implications that that has. And by cultural, I begin with sort of business culture and industrial culture. So who are the very people who can be in this business because of the digitalization of something like the journalism industry? So for example, in photojournalism, Corbis and Getty Images, which were the two very prominent visual content providers that dominated the scene for an extended period of time, neither one of them grew out of journalistic know-how or even journalistic experience, right? One was started by Bill Gates, and the other one was started by the Getty brothers, two investment bankers. So it was really about who had the capital and who had the technical know-how to build these visual content providers. So I think what we're seeing is, on the one hand, an increasing demand for visuals, but I worry that we're also seeing a surplus of ever more vacuous, faster visuals. And part of this is, of course, because the idea that everybody is a videographer, everybody is a photographer, has meant that there's less and less funding for professional photography, professional videography, and professional photo editing or video editing just in newsrooms.
Thinking particularly about the speed and the circulation and the disappearance of professional brokers, I'm wondering what that does to the people or things represented or shown in news images. I'm wondering whether, because there's no sort of like a one less layer of, I suppose they were editorial in a way, like the brokers, or a back and forth, or a thoughtful process, or a labor which was professional and which had gone through training and so on. Even though we can find problems in all of those professions, I'm wondering, has there been maybe then a loss of dignity to some extent for those people who were pictured?
Look, on the one hand, I think it's important to remember that the digital promise was that more people would be able to contribute to the world, to the photographs that were circulated around the world. And that, I think, we have seen. I mean, when I go to a photojournalism festival today, I see photographers from many more parts of the world. There isn't really, you can't make an argument that there's a place in the world where you couldn't find a photographer and therefore you have to send somebody from Paris or New York. So I think that that's a wonderful thing. I observed a lot of very thoughtful conversations between photo editors and photographers. Now, photojournalists will often complain about photo editors not, you know, taking the best images or asking for asinine images. But I mean, I can say firsthand that I saw many photo editors staying in the office well past midnight, researching the story they were working on, asking clarifying questions to the photographers, you know, really trying to verify the story, thinking about the ethics of images. And I just simply think there are very few people today who can afford that kind of time. Photographers are getting assigned to do projects in a day or even multiple projects in a day, as opposed to when they might have had, you know, a week, 2 weeks to really delve into a story. So in terms of loss of dignity, we're all getting flatter visual stories, I think. We're getting massive doses of flatter visual stories, and we have to look harder for visual depth. But it is out there because there's a lot of talent in the world producing photojournalism.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for this answer and for all your others. It's been a real pleasure having you on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Zainab, for joining us on the podcast.
It's very nice to be with you today.
In this middle part of the podcast, I want to tell you that we are part of the wider initiative For Digital Dignity. Go to fordigitaldignity.com or check out the Facebook page For Digital Dignity. If you want to get in touch, then email me at onlinegodspodcast@gmail.com or tweet at me at Ian Mick Cook. I should also tell you that the project, officially called Online Art Poll, has received funding from the European Research Council Starting Grant, Agreement Number 714285, and is led by Sahan Udupa, Professor of Media Anthropology at the Department of Social and Cultural Anthropology at LMU Munich. And the project is in full swing. If you check out the journal Contemporary South Asia, then you can find a special issue on Neo-Hindutva, edited by a member of our team, Senior Research Fellow Edward Anderson, along with Arkatong Longkuma. And the interview in there with Christophe Jaffrelot is causing many ripples. And the issue also includes Sahana's article on Enterprise Hindutva. And Sahana has been really busy writing not only that article, but also an article on extreme speech for EPW Engage. And also an article with me about the experience of making this podcast, also for the same publication, Economic Political Weekly Engage. I should also tell you that there was an international symposium called Internet Speech, Perspectives on Regulation and Policy, which was held in Delhi at the beginning of the month, and I'm sure we'll be hearing about the outcomes of that sometime soon. All right, before the break, I hope you enjoyed listening to our talk with Zainab. It gave me a lot to think about. But the one thing I want to pick up on here is how power over circulation is becoming more diffuse, and the actors who are choosing pictures spend less and less time deliberating over a choice of image. Now, one of the effects of this, Zainab suggested, was that we get flatter news images within the world of circulation. And this had me thinking about other types of circulation and decision-making, specifically the circulation of our data and what thought and consideration is being put into how and when it circulates. I mean, if you think about it, if I would like my image brokers to put more time and thought into the photographs that get chosen to go on news sites, I should probably also have more time and thought for myself when I give my permission away upon installing a new app on my phone. But if you're anything like me, then you're probably just like, yes, come on, I need to use the app right now. Well, somebody who does think a lot about this issue and tries to get other people to think about it as well is Nayantara Ranganathan, a program manager at the Internet Democracy Project, which is based in Delhi, India. Nayantara manages the Freedom of Expression program and works on the planning, coordination, research and advocacy relating to this, and also how they speak to gender, net neutrality and surveillance. And I have to say, I am really, really happy to have her on the podcast. Welcome, Nayantara, to Online Gods. It's really great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Ian. I'm excited to be here.
Great. So I want to jump with a bit of a provocative question to begin with. Why does India, or indeed anywhere, need a project that democratizes the internet?
A project that democratizes the internet. Okay, well, I guess the internet fundamentally restructures many of our democratic institutions as we understand it, and has, at least from the outset, been this force, or has been perceived to be this force for democracy. It has democratized all kinds of things, like given an avenue for people that might not have had access to media. But then, of course, like so many years down the line, I think that has really turned on its head. So I feel like it is a time where we're interrogating how each of our democracies is able to grapple with the kind of shifts in politics and culture that the internet brings. So, yeah, I think that's why we're all obsessing over the question.
And what are those shifts? Like, what sort of shifts has the internet brought?
I guess the first thing that comes to mind is, of course, how it has shifted media, but also all of the other institutions, you know, like how the executive or the legislature, the courts are kind of approaching the internet. I don't know. The first thing that comes to mind is this recent thing that has been unraveling, where the courts are looking to create a portal, which essentially, because it is very hard to serve summons upon people that might be outside the country, is going to put summons on a portal and will deem that the summons be served. So it's kind of funny when you think about it, that what the court assumes is that all people at all times in the world have to be refreshing the page of this the courts of India to understand if they have been served a summons. You know, so I guess, because the architecture of the internet is kind of fundamentally changing how we do commerce, how we do social relationships, how we do politics, everything, I guess it is restructuring how all of us work at many different levels.
I was wondering, like, if you can maybe talk a little bit about the sort of work the organization you work for does. Like, what sort of activities do you do with the sort of democratizing mission that you have in mind?
Okay, so currently we're working on... We have been working for a while on trying to understand what is unpacking surveillance, but because it is, for many people who don't work in the space of digital rights or in new media, it's, surveillance is this idea that is very abstract, that is very far away, comes from the government, and also brings with it this sense of if I haven't done anything wrong, then I shouldn't really be so concerned about surveillance. But so the work that we have been trying to do is looking at how surveillance is actually extremely gendered within the Indian society, and perhaps elsewhere too, and what that can help us extrapolate to, like, broader debates about surveillance with the state, for example. Should I unpack that a bit?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I know specifically, when I first came across your work, it was through seeing you talking on a YouTube video, I think somewhere, about apps for women, or about safety apps. And I was wondering, like, can you tell us a little bit about this? Because I know this is sort of a thing. I know, like, women who I know in India who maybe aren't always the most, critically minded, they install these apps on their phone. And I always asked them about it. And I'm sort of fascinated about it. So I'm wondering, like, what sort of work have you done around this sort of safety apps for women that have become pretty popular?
So this phenomenon of safety apps has been quite a few years now. And basically, we started noticing a lot of hackathons, a lot of newspaper articles, a lot of initiatives from all kinds of different actors where they would release a safety app, because safety for women is a perennially burning issue in India. But we noticed that a lot of state budget, for example, meant for safety of women would be either going into installing CCTV cameras or building apps, or very much this technological solutionism driven agenda. And of course, not just from the state, but also, say, political parties, private actors who were genuinely interested in women's safety. So all kinds of actors, right? But I think it was very interesting for us to look at this issue, because it I think is a great example to also think about how issues like safety, issues like even welfare delivery, for example, all of these palatable ideas that everyone can get behind are actually very easy vehicles for surveillance initiatives to be, to proliferate. So in the case of the safety apps, for example, we looked at 50 different apps in the Indian market, selected on the basis of either ones that were making it to the listicles or the ones that had the most number of downloads. And we kind of wanted to look at how or whether it is helping women and just understand the features, understand the ecosystem behind it, what happens to the data, and what that does structurally to the issue of women's safety. So that was the study about.
Okay, and could you give me an example of maybe just for those people who aren't familiar with how these safety app works, like what sort of features do they have? Why? What's the appeal for people to use them?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So, for example, a lot of these features of these safety apps, we grouped them into, I think, 4 or 5 broad trends. But most of them essentially reduce the time that it takes to call for help in a situation of emergency or danger. And so, for example, if I'm in a position of if I foresee that I will be somewhere where I think I will be subject to some kind of danger, then I will beforehand kind of set someone on my phone to be my guardian or whatever other funny things they call such positions on the apps. And essentially, I can send an alert at a time where something's wrong. So often either this alert is someone that I could know, or it can be the police, or it can go to my social media account. It can be different actors. But essentially what it kind of also was doing was entrenching a lot of surveillance and a lot of control that happens within families, but in the name of broader safety. So, for example, one of the most alarming examples for me was this idea of geofencing, where essentially if someone thinks that they should get an alert when I go outside of a particular locality, then that was possible, of course, with my consent sometimes. But still, the idea that there was no autonomy to be unbothered and like safe without anyone else's intervention for me was, for us as a project, was a bit alarming.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've sat there, in drinking tea with a man in India while he was watching his wife make her way home by GPS, you know, and that was the first time I came across it, and it was totally, it was sort of surprising to me. And when I tried to question him about it, like, you know, about things like freedom and trust and so on, like, but again, like the idea of safety was so, how to say, such a dominant narrative for him and in their family, that like he couldn't see any possible reason why it's wrong. So I'm wondering, like, when you were doing this research and when you were talking I suppose to people around you when you were doing this research, did you come across any sort of resistance, like people saying like, but why are you doing this stuff? Come on, safety is a good thing, like, you know, stop causing trouble.
Not really. In fact, to the contrary, we found it quite hard to find people who had actually used or like rely on these apps. So it was in fact quite hard to find people that were using these and relying on these. No, I think safety in general is like this proxy term that is used to mean that you want to be unbothered. But of course, in the academic realm, there are competing understandings of what else we can call it. And I think this work called Why Loiter by some folks in Bombay basically makes the argument that safety is this very paternalistic kind of understanding, and what we should be looking for is the ability to have risk. The book is more broadly about women in public spaces, but I think that also equally applies to the internet. And even in our work, we kind of try to think through why safety might not be the best framework within which to understand women's taking up space in on the internet or in meet space, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. for that matter.
And thinking about surveillance more broadly, I'm wondering what can a organization like yours do to help ameliorate some of the issues around online surveillance, either with apps or another means? Like, apart, you mentioned here research, but what else can you do to somehow combat the worst issues that are surrounding this?
I don't know if we ameliorate surveillance, but I guess what we're able to do is really make those problematize a lot of surveillance tendencies in many different kinds of legislations, policy shifts, business models that are getting entrenched. So, for example, from very specific kinds of legislations like the trafficking bill, which seeks to, you know, establish institutions and affordances to create surveillance to tackle this, like, transnational crime of trafficking, to something more like the fintech sector, what it does in the name of financial inclusion, creating this kind of profiling of broad groups of people that might not have access to finance. So these two examples to me are like done in the name of these palatable things, either safety, financial inclusion, welfare delivery, all of these things, but always kind of having to trade off some autonomy, some dignity, if you will. So to me, I guess what we do is kind of look for these paternalistic approaches, see how we can do that differently. But I guess outside of that policy space, we also do workshops with, for example, with the recent one that we did was this, with this group called the Feminist Approach to Technology, who work with young girls on technology, but also on rights and how the two are intertwined. Where also, I think there are a lot of very interesting things that emerge. For example, the kind of discourse on anonymity that happens in policy spaces is really different from the kinds of discourse on anonymity that happens at these workshops with the young girls, because they have a lot more visceral understanding of surveillance, which is very concrete, which is from families and which is from boyfriends. And I guess making these connections is what we do.
Can you talk about any, I suppose policy always takes a long time, but I'm wondering if you can maybe talk about some sort of, I know, examples where you've realized, where you've actually seen an impact, sort of a direct impact, maybe at workshops or elsewhere, where you've actually managed to say, okay, yeah, now the work that I've done really has changed something.
Well, the workshop that I was just talking to you comes to mind, because I think at the same workshops, there are different people at different levels of understanding or comfort with technology participate. And kind of, I think how to use a mouse comes at the same time as why do we need to talk about rights when we need to understand technology? Like, this kind of discussions happen parallelly. And sometimes a lot of people are quite aghast at, say, the kind of data sharing that happens, or like what permissions mean when these apps take permissions for all kinds of things on your phones. So it's always interesting to see the reaction of people, which is quite outraged at these practices. But they also say, for example, this person said, now that I have all of this understanding, I might go and be able to like tell my son about it, but he will probably say, "Tu badi tez ban gayi hai," which basically means you have become very fast, and basically dismiss her. I don't know. Why I mentioned that is because on the one hand, it is a counter argument to this idea that people don't care about their data going away, or they're willing to exchange it for things like convenience, safety, comfort, etc. And on the other hand, very much also speaks to the reality that a lot of women are expected to either not understand technology, or when they do, considered dangerous or kind of likely to be dismissed. So it's very interesting working with young girls or older women who have sons who have a lot more access to phones. that is more of a space with, I guess, what you can call impact.
All right. Yeah. As a final question, it's a final question that we ask all our guests on the podcast. It's about the question of digital dignity, which is this podcast is part of a bigger project. So I'm wondering, like, with your work in mind, what do you think digital dignity might mean to you?
Digital dignity for me would be the absence of this kind of helplessness that comes in, because on the one hand, you desire something. It could be someone who is trying to get welfare from the state, which they are rightfully owed, or safety in public spaces, private spaces. But there is something that you are expected to give up, some level of helplessness in that giving up, which for me is an erosion of dignity. So digital dignity would be, for me, the lack of coercion, whether it is like not having to give up my entire 360-degree profile in order to be able to get a loan in today's day and age, or the existence of surveillance cameras in all of our public spaces in exchange for this paternalistic notion of safety. So not having to exchange anything and not having to be helpless in that transaction.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Nayantara, for this answer and for all your answers. It's been really wonderful having you on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
I really enjoyed speaking with Nayantara. Making this podcast always makes me realize how much I don't know. And it's always wonderful speaking to people like her because they're actively engaged in trying to increase our knowledge about the workings of the internet in a way that I think increases the possibility for digital dignity. I think the speed of change makes understanding what we are trading away when we use supposedly free apps and other online tools is really, really crucial. Anyway, that is it from us this week. Get in touch with love, abuse, and polite criticism. Seeing people say nice things about the podcast always makes us smile. And of course, it's always good to get constructive feedback so we can do things better moving forward. All right then. Ta-da! Thank you so much for listening to the Online Gods podcast. Online Gods is part of the project Online ARPOL, funded by the European Research Council, starting grant agreement number 714285. The project's PI is Sahana Udapa, who's Professor of Media Anthropology at the Department of Social and Cultural Anthropology, Ludwig Maximilian University, Munich, Germany. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Goodbye.